Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Savage Nation, welcome to the program. The big news is that Harry Reid called Obama a light-skinned African-American with no Negro dialect. You play Blue Monday. What a Blue Monday it is for the Democrats. Can you imagine that Harry Reid is quoted in a new book as having said that the reason Obama is appealing is that he's a light-skinned African-American with no Negro dialect? Now, if a Republican had said this, it's the end of the road. Hysteria from the highest towers. Hysteria and the demand for scalps. But that Harry Reid said it in the midst of trying to push health care, socialized medicine reform, is amazing to me. But look, let's be clear. Reid is not the first Democrat to have used, let's say, quasi-racist remarks about Obama. Bill Clinton, it was revealed, it's revealed that Bill Clinton said during the presidential campaign of 08 that a few years ago, Barack Obama would have been getting him coffee. Did you hear this? Even the late leftist Ted Kennedy, to whom Clinton apparently made the remark, was disgusted to the point that Kennedy refused to support Hillary for president. And so, therefore, what is this all about? Well, it's about a lot of things. It's about a double standard. It's about the fact that the Democrats are what they really are, not what they pretend to be. And things of that nature. But as I say, Harry Reid's not the first one to say that about Democrats, nor is Obama the first Democrat to speak in different dialects. I want to remind you that other candidates have spoken in different cadences according to whichever audience they're in front of. Because when speaking to black audiences, Obama's consonants tended to linger a bit. Obama would speak with a certain staccato and rhythm, particularly in black churches, that he would not use when addressing white audiences in Iowa or New Hampshire. But you got to remember, the same is true of other white politicians. Bill and Hillary Clinton, for example, when a Southern accent is needed, they certainly know how to use them below the Mason-Dixon line. Do you have the one of Hillary speaking in tongues?
I don't feel no ways tired. I come too far from where I started from. Nobody told me that the road would be easy. I don't believe he brought me this far to leave me.
Now, if that's not the voice of someone channeling someone else or someone who's outright crazy, I'd like to know what is. But anyway, let's put that aside. That's history. That's one topic. There's another topic, which is very near and dear to me. I've decided to spend a good portion of the rest of my time on Earth defending ending lab testing on chimpanzees. Let me be very blunt with you. I want to end all lab testing on chimpanzees, and I'm going to explain why. Let me take us back to where we are. The Islamofascists are dehumanizing the world by killing even their own co-religionists with such brutality and a lack of humanity. Many of us are starting to become less and less human on this planet. And in the midst of fighting an Islamofascist enemy that treats its victims less than human, we must remember and reaffirm our own humanity. We must remember that we have a responsibility to the innocent animals that God has placed on this earth. And because of that, and because of the fact that technology has eliminated the need for lab testing on chimpanzees, I am going to work to end such cruel and inhumane testing immediately. Now, I know there are others who have been working on this for ages, but I'm going to join them. You see, chimpanzees have a similar range of emotions to humans. Chimps feel themselves being strapped to a gurney. They feel when they're being tortured in a lab. They feel when they're being given diseases. They can also see their mates and friends being tortured in front of their eyes in laboratories, because all you got to do is go into a lab and hear them screaming out as their mate or their family or their friends are strapped to a gurney and tortured by these sick doctors. I say end all animal experiments on chimpanzees now. Now you say, Savage, where is this coming from all of a sudden? Is this something new? How come you're all of a sudden concerned about chimpanzees? In a way, it's new, and in a way, it's old. I began as a graduate student a long time ago. In fact, I don't know if I told you the story, but I lost a fellowship in 1968 in a laboratory because I wouldn't kill lab animals. Let me take you back there for a minute. In case you have the wrong impression of me, you may as well get the right impression of me. I think it was 1968, and I went back to graduate school as somewhat of an adult at the time, and I was working in a pharmacology laboratory. I won't say which university, which I really detested doing, because I heard my ancestors speaking to me and saying, you've come this far in life to clean rat feces? But what I couldn't do was, I didn't want to kill even the rats. I wouldn't kill them. There was a midget that worked in the laboratory, to the rats, as she broke their necks and really pithed their spines. So here was what happened. I had no money. I was a young graduate student, and I had a $300 a month stipend. $300 a month was enough to live on in those days. I had nothing else. I just arrived in this faraway place with my then girlfriend, and the lab guy who brought me out there said, here's the ultimatum that you have. You either kill the animals like you're supposed to, or I'm pulling your fellowship. I said, well, go ahead and pull my fellowship because I'm not killing animals. And I left the lab, and I had to wander around, and I wound up in a botany laboratory, and that's when I moved into botany because I didn't think I'd have to kill animals. But the point I'm making is, we have an obligation to be good shepherds to our animal friends. And chimpanzees, of all the animals, of all of them, they are so close to us genetically. There's only a few enzymatic differences between us and chimps. I know many of you find it offensive because you don't even understand what I'm saying to you. But the truth is, they're very closely related to us. The important thing to know is that they have a full range of emotions. Their bad luck... Here's their bad luck. The bad luck for chimps is that they get the same disease as we do. And because they get the same disease as we do, the chimps are often substituted for humans in laboratories. So they're tortured by these sadistic so-called scientists for medical research. Now, I'm not against medical research, but I understand that with the advent of the computer and modeling, computer modeling, there's no need to do this to chimpanzees at all. And if you go into a laboratory, as I say, and you see what they do to chimpanzees, I think most of you would agree with me, your stomach would turn. When they take out one of the family members or friends of a chimpanzee, you say they don't know what's going on, listen to them scream in pain and go crazy as they watch their brother, their uncle, their cousin, or their girlfriend being strapped to a gurney by a sadist in a white coat. And as you hear their friend struggling to free themselves from the drugs and the chains to the gurney, believe me, they have the same range of emotions. It would be like experimenting on a human being by Dr. Mengele, as far as I'm concerned. Now, I wouldn't apply the same to a rat. I wouldn't apply the same to a rabbit. I would apply this concept to a chimpanzee owing to the close similarity between the chimpanzee and the human being. So that's one of the topics I really do want to talk about, which is ending animal testing on chimpanzees. And if you think this is an odd thing for a conservative talk show host to be talking about, you're right, because I'm not a conservative talk show host. I'm an independent. That is correct. I actually walk the walk and I talk the talk. I'll be right back.
Savage.
I can talk about Obama and the Democrats till I'm blue in the face. And, you know, I do once in a while go into that because it's important what they're trying to do to this country. And you can hear it elsewhere. What you're not going to hear elsewhere is what I'm talking about today, which is my campaign to end lab testing on chimpanzees. I've been searching for over a year now, searching my soul, as it were, of what to do with the few good years I may have left on this earth. And the more I have studied this, the more I realize it brings me back to my beginnings in science, where I refused to kill animals. And it really did a lot of good for me, as a matter of fact, by walking out on that bastard's laboratory. By the way, he eventually died of brain cancer. It's a funny thing, which is not to say that everyone who gets brain cancer was torturing animals, but I thought it was quite interesting that this very doctor who threw me out of the lab because I wouldn't kill animals, and he knew I had nowhere to go. I mean, he gave me an ultimatum, you know, either you kill the animals or I'm taking back your fellowship. I had nothing, but I always found in life, and I've done this in business too, I've walked out of business deals when I had almost nothing, where there was a lot of money on the table, where I knew my heart would die if I stayed another day in a certain company. And I did this years ago. I won't even tell you the company. And I quit that day and left the city. I didn't even know what tomorrow would bring. And you know what it brought me? Radio. And I have found in my life that whenever I let my instincts, my soul, whatever you want to say, dictate the course of my events, it always works out best for me. And that's why I'm saying I think that we need to focus today as an American people on what's happening to us as people. The Islamo-fascists are dehumanizing the world. When you see them cutting Daniel Pearl's throat and you hear the blood-curdling cry, of course, that's been buried because you're not supposed to remember who they really are. Or when you hear them making him say, I am a Jew, my mother was a Jew, my father was a Jew, and then they cut his head off. Again, you're not supposed to remember any of that. That's one thing, but we must not let the Islamo-fascists dehumanize us. I didn't say don't fight them. In fact, I would say kill more of them would be better than killing less of them, because to me, they're lower than a chimpanzee. How do you like that? They're not even worthy of the name human, people who do things like that. But what we can do is remember that we have a responsibility to protect these innocent creatures that God has placed on this earth along with us. There is no need to experiment and torture these chimpanzees anymore. They can use computer modeling. There are other ways to do this. This is a throwback to the 19th century, and many of the people that I have met in my life in animal research are the most sadistic people on the planet, and they use the animals to work out their sadism. You know, and I know many of you are saying, you know, what's he talking about? This is not conservative. A real man, you know, eats animals and kills them. Well, you know what? Say what you want. I'm telling you what I think. That's all. New York City, WOR, Anna, welcome to the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Thank you so much, Dr. Savage, for talking about this. It's a testament to your humanity, and if I ever hear a liberal insult you again, I'm just going to bring this up, because you have the courage to discuss this issue. These chimps.
Well, I don't know whether it's a liberal-conservative issue. I think it's a human issue, and I think this is something that should unite all of us. I want to be very clear. I believe that we as a species are becoming dehumanized by the Islamo-fascists. When we see how they treat their fellow co-religionists even, blowing up marketplaces, killing fellow Muslims, all in the name of some political ideology that they mask in a religious ideology, we cannot let them dehumanize us. And I'm saying the best way to make to save our humanity is to save the animals. How's that?
Yeah, absolutely. I've talked to people, friends of mine who work in pharmaceutical companies, though, and similar to what happens with the Islamo-fascists is the way that you get used to working in this field, and it's a dehumanizing practice, you know?
That's right, exactly. Oh, well, I'm just going to go to work today and take a chimpanzee. I'm going to inject them with a tranquilizer. His family members are going to scream in the cages that he was brought in with. As we wheel him out in a gurney and he's helpless, and then when we poke him and prod him and, let's say, maybe blind him, take an eye out of him, you can hear the other animals screaming through the wall because they know what's going on. No, this has to end.
Absolutely, and it's one step.
I'll tell you something. We should see more of these videos rather than fewer. That's all. Remember, I told you I walked out of I want to make it about me, but it is about me. You got to understand, it is about me. People have a history in their life, and very often their history is fraudulently altered for political reasons. So this is what I want to do right now. 1-800-449-8255, Kansas City, Mike, you're up on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Hey, Michael, I just wanted to quote William Blake in support of the great English poet, in support of what you're saying. And it's each outcry of the hunted hare, a fiber from the brain does tear. A horse misused upon the road calls to heaven for human blood. And, you know, what you're really saying, Michael, is what the many of the great Jewish rabbis did in their day to protect society from moving in the direction of the greater sins. They built walls where you knew you were getting in breaking distance of the greater sins. So by being humane to the chimpanzees, what you're really saying is we need to build a wall from sliding into greater inhumanity in our
exactly. We're going to slide into inhumanity to man. Man to man inhumanity is going to get worse and worse until people feel nothing whatsoever. If you combine with what the Islamo-fascists are doing to the human condition, with the drugging of the Western population, which numbs their feelings, people's feelings, they feel nothing or next to nothing. We're very close to experimenting on human beings and saying, oh, who cares? It's only, you know, a human being. And so I don't know. This is coming up in me today. Maybe it's the mood I'm in or whatever. But it really goes back over 30 years to my early days in science when I walked out on that fellowship. I have to remind myself that I did it because I had forgotten about it.
Yeah,
and I thank you for the call. I want to bring something up. The man touched on something about the element of ethnicity here. Many of you have heard of kosher meat, but you don't know what it is. You hear the word kosher means clean. But the word kosher is about ritual slaughter. The animal really is killed in a humane way. You say, well, how can you kill an animal humanely? Well, there's a big difference between killing an animal slowly and killing an animal quickly for food. And I read that the whole purpose of the kosher food laws was not so much about clean. I read this interpretation was not solely about clean food, but it was to maintain the humanity of the early Jews. Because otherwise, if you start slaughtering animals in an inhumane way, you become bestial yourself. And it's only a matter of time until you start to behave that way to other humans. Remember that. I'm just saying, end lab testing on chimpanzees now.
Savage.
So Harry Reid makes a racist, offhanded, I don't know, quasi-racist remark about Obama. You could say it wasn't racist. I mean, he calls Obama a light-skinned African-American with no Negro dialect. Then we read in this new book that's out that Bill Clinton in 08 was allegedly to have said Barack Obama would have been getting them coffee. I mean, it's unbelievable to me. And if a Republican had said any of these things, you could just imagine the outcome. And yet we hear nothing from the fellow travelers, the fifth columnists in the media. But listen to what in clip 9... I like Michael Steele, by the way, of the RNC. I think he does a fine job. I never met the gentleman, but I actually think he's doing a great job. Listen to what Michael Steele himself, an African-American, a Republican, has to say about Harry Reid's Negro comments.
This term, this like he's going to pass, for example, for white America because he's, you know, got this Negro dialect that he can turn on or turn off and he's light-skinned. That's anachronistic language. It harkens back to the 1950s and 60s, and it confirms for me a mindset that is out of step with where America is today. But I can assure you that if I had, as national chairman, said that, well, it's all behind us and he's apologized, let's move on, no one would be accepting that. There has to be a consequence here if the standard is the one that was set in 2002 with Trent Lott.
Yeah, that's right. Well, we know there's a double standard. So there's nothing new about that. And as I said, the cadence changes according to the audience. You know how Hillary changed her accent. I played that in the last segment. It's very funny. But, when they're in front of different audiences, they change their cadence. When Hillary goes, I think when they go to Boca Raton, they speak in a different accent. You think I speak in a rising inflection in a nursing home? I wonder why. Well, when Hillary went to a black church, remember what she said? Listen to this one. That was, you can't forget that one.
I don't feel no ways tired. I come too far from where I started from. Nobody told me that the road would be easy. I don't believe he brought me this far to leave me.
It's unbelievable to me. It's incomprehensible. it's just incomprehensible. That's why I'd rather talk about chimpanzees than Harry Reid. You understand? At least I can do something positive here. With Harry Reid and the Clintons, there's nothing positive can come out of it. Let's put it to you that way. And talking about corruption in Washington, is nothing positive is going to come out of it until we get to go to the voting booth. That's why I'm talking about chimpanzees. Chimps are humans' closest living relatives. And more than 1,000 chimps, some who were captured from the wild or used by the entertainment industry and kept as pets and given away, currently live in 9 biomedical research and testing labs around the U.S. And I'm reading now from the Director of Program Management Animal Research Issues of the Humane Society of the United States, and I intend to give them a sizable donation. They write that despite expensive knowledge of their rich social and emotional lives and their ineffectiveness as models for human diseases like HIV, chimps continue to be subjected to painful and invasive experiments, some for more than 40 years. However, at any given time, the vast majority of chimpanzees in labs are not being used. While their care and maintenance is spending taxpayer dollars, they say it's time to end the wasteful and poor treatment of our closest living and endangered relatives. Now, the reason I think that's important is because of the dehumanization that's going on around the world as a result of many factors, primarily the inhumane behavior of the Islamo-fascists toward the rest of humanity, including their co-religionists. Okay? And what I'm saying is we cannot permit the Islamo-fascists to dehumanize us. And the best way for us to retain our humanity, even if you are misanthropic, which many of you are for good reason, is to love animals more. Now, I didn't say become a vegetarian necessarily. That's certainly a choice you can make. I am not a vegetarian. You say, well, then you're hypocritical. I am not hypocritical for two reasons. Yes, a cow feels. And yes, I understand a lamb feels. I understand all of that. But I also understand that there's a difference between a cow and a lamb and a chimpanzee owing to the range of emotions that are felt by a chimpanzee. And I don't think anyone has answered the question the way I've just answered it, because I've discussed this actually all my whole life with people. No, a cow does feel, but not in the same manner as a chimpanzee. And you have to understand that. It's the same with a dog. I would end the eating of dogs in China and Korea if I had the power to do so. You say, well, that's hypocritical because cows feel not the same way dogs feel. Anyone who's owned a dog can tell you that a dog is very, very capable of a variety of human emotions. And we cannot let these Islamo-fascist throwbacks dehumanize us any further. And since we cannot do anything against them because our government is so impotent, incompetent, or God knows what the reasons are. We have the most powerful military on earth, and it's hardly being used. We also understand that as well. So we can turn somewhat within, and we can, you know, maybe become more humane here in our own world. I don't know how exactly I'm trying to articulate this on the radio, and that's why I'm talking with you about this today. 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. Jimmy in New York. Welcome to the Savage Nation from WOR. Where do you stand on this issue?
Well, I don't want to see dogs or cats tortured, and chimps neither. But I heard that the way the Jewish people make the animal kosher is actually cruel. They cut the cow's throat. That's not a clean kill.
Well, that's a little anti-Semitic, because how are cows killed in a regular slaughterhouse is the question.
They hit him like, you know, that thing that with No Time for Old Men, that thing there, that guy to kill, that's what they hit him with.
Yeah. Well, I guess you'd have to go to the slaughterhouse and find out which is more humane. There's a difference between, if you read the kosher food laws, it says you must use a sharp knife, not a dull knife. Now, the reason for the sharp knife is so that the slaughter is quick rather than slow. As you well know, your friends from the Middle East, from Pakistan and Krapistan, when they cut someone's head off, they use a very dull, serrated knife to cut off a human's head. Did you know that?
I watched one on
They cut as slow as they can. I don't know how much more we can take of this garbage of denying what we see in front of our own eyes. Denying it. Turning our heads away from who they are. Like, they have a legitimate complaint. There are a lot of blow up a marketplace and kill men, women, and children, or take down an airliner. And the liberals would almost argue that they're this way cool and they're just expressing their territorial imperative. San Diego, Jay, you're next up on the Savage Nation.
Hi. Pleasure to speak with you. I'm a little taken back right now. I've never really heard you speak like this on the show. I've listened quite a bit. I'm a young guy, 23 years old. I just graduated from university. But I'd have to say you sound a lot like some of my professors right now with the way that you're describing animals and their emotions and what they feel.
Well, wait a minute. Hold on, my friend. Do you think because I'm a conservative I'm supposed to walk in lockstep with Rush Limbaugh?
No, not at all. I don't understand how...
Don't expect a disc jockey who got lucky to have any knowledge of such issues as I am discussing today. I have done many things in my life. I doubt very much if any of the other talkers in radio have worked in science as I have. I've seen firsthand the kinds of sadists in the field of so-called science and medicine and how they use animals basically to get off on them.
Well, that's completely different. I mean that's a different topic. I can't say that I've seen that.
Well, here's the point that maybe I didn't make clearly, and perhaps I have to repeat it again. There are potentials today for computer modeling that could be used instead of chimpanzees. There is absolutely no justification whatsoever for using chimpanzees and orangutans in medical research. That's as simple as I can make it.
Telling me they feel what humans feel as far as emotions go?
Very close to it, yes. If you've actually been around them as their mates are being strapped into a gurney and tortured and you hear them scream, you'd know what I'm talking about. Have you ever actually been in a laboratory and seen them behave?
I mean, I've been to the zoo where they've been behind bars and behind walls, but I don't know how they behave when they're being operated on or when they're being tested on. I mean, I've seen them
throw... Well, you can pretty much... Well, let's back up a minute, Jay. Are you aware that chimpanzees genetically are very similar to humans?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay, so there's a separation of a very few degrees of... You call them genes, I call them enzymes, frankly. It's only a few enzymes that separate us from the chimpanzees. And their human, the range of emotions in a chimpanzee are very similar to ours. And so I know you're afraid of going soft, you know, and if you listen to this, you're liable to become a liberal. It's not going to happen. It's going to make you a better American and a better patriot to listen to me. Believe me, you'll come out of this a better man rather than a weaker man. And I don't think men should fear feeling anything for animals. This is another thing that has to be talked about. I think it makes you a stronger rather than a weaker man to feel things. And I think that people become hardened, so to speak, or brittle, become useless to themselves and everyone around them. So we don't have to beat this up. I mean, I made my point. I'm going to make a donation. I'll have the people on from the organizations that do this. If you want to talk about it, give me a call. Florida. We have a caller out of Florida on the topic. Aaron, thanks for calling. What do you think about the use of chimps and higher primates in research?
Well, it's horrible. I work at a large African wildlife preserve here in Florida, and we have 30, give or take, chimpanzees, and a lot of them came from polio research.
Mm. You know, I've given money over the years to Chimp Haven. Is that near you?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, well, I think Chimp Haven is a refuge for animals that were used for decades in research and then were given away by the labs, and they care for them. And I've given money to them. I mean, I have a weak spot for poor animals because they're defenseless.
Yeah, they are. You know, they're taken from their homes. You know, just like a lot of other animals that don't belong in captivity. You know, and they're taken out of Africa, and they're subjected to this horrible cruelty. You know, and there are
well,
people.
So you see, this is not a liberal or conservative issue, is it? And I think that this is the problem, is a lot of conservatives who listen to the others think that it's almost unmasculine or not conservative to have sympathy for the plight of animals. This is something I'd like to change, if I could, Aaron.
Yeah, you know, me too. I work with animals because I love them. You know,
Well, I've always, the people I have met in my life who actually work for the betterment of these innocent creatures are, to me, as close to saints on the planet that I could ever find. I have no faith in humanity anymore. At this point, I have no faith in humanity. I think people are terrible, by and large. I think people are about the worst animal there is on the planet. But when I see humans, they can usually defend themselves, except if they're crippled or something like that, then you have to defend them. But by and large, human beings are as aggressive and as mean an animal as God ever made.
Absolutely.
maybe you didn't expect to hear that from me either. You know, it's too bad. It's just the way it is. It's what's on my mind. So, look, you want to talk about this. You want to talk about Reid calling Obama a light-skinned African-American with no Negro dialect that came out in a new book this weekend. A light-skinned African-American with no Negro dialect, unless he wanted to have one. I mean, is that a racist statement? Is that a racist statement or not? What do you think? I mean, remember when Trent Lott said something in 2004? What happened in this country when all of the, quote, black activists went wild in the country in order to get over on the Republicans? Today, they're backing Harry Reid, as you can expect, because you understand where they're coming from. You know who High Jackson always has been. And you know, all you got to do is say when you see, what's his name, Al Sharpton, think Freddie's Fashion Mart. That's all. 1-800-449-8255. MichaelSavage.com. San Diego, Steve, you're up on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Hello?
Yes, Steve, go ahead, please.
Oh, okay. Dr. Savage. Yes, I worked. I talked to you about Bill Putney, you know, with the dogs and all that, the war dogs. And but I worked a show called Project X when they experimented with the chimpanzees. They put them in a fake airplane, and they flew them, and then they did a bomb thing to see how far they could fly after being zapped by all this radiation.
Oh, so you mean that was a movie you were working on?
Yeah, Project X. It was done in about 1983 or 4.
What, are you suggesting that they were abused during the movie? Is that what you're saying?
No. Definitely not. No. The handlers and everybody else, but the chimpanzees, man, I mean, I was around them for like a month, and I'll tell you, you almost got close to them.
Yeah, well, you look in their eyes, you know what I'm talking about, huh?
Yeah, definitely. Now, we had some of the older ones that actually were almost up in the 80s that, you know, we had to stay away from them because they were a little more like my grandfather or something like that.
Right. Somebody said to me the other night at dinner, they said, you do know when they get old, they get very ornery. I said, and you don't?
Oh, God. Oh, man. Yeah. We have to stay away.
They become like old people, very set in their ways and very mean.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God.
I know. They're just that. I say that they're very much like us in that regard.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, because I spent, this was at Fox Studios, and God, you know, it was unbelievable. We had the young ones and the old ones. And the young.
Well, you know the case of the woman whose face was torn off in Connecticut about 2 years ago?
I heard about it.
You know, let me explain that case. Remember that story in Connecticut where a woman kept a chimpanzee in her house from the time it was young, and then a friend came and he tore the friend's face off, and then it had to be killed by a cop? Okay. You don't know the whole story on that one. I actually followed that story in detail. I got to take a break, but the minute I come back, I'm going to give you a hint. Do you know that this woman was taking baths with that chimpanzee? She was having wine dinners with the chimpanzee. She was sleeping in a bed with the chimpanzee. So don't blame the chimp, necessarily. Blame the woman. I'll be right back.
Savage.
It is the Savage way. It's the way of, how shall I put it, the truth. Wherever it leads me, that's where I go. So why do I oppose global warming hysteria? Because even though I'm a scientist trained in other fields, I can read the literature. Let's put it to you that way. Most of you can't. So I can read peer-reviewed literature. Big deal, peer-reviewed, for what it means today. And the peer-reviewed literature is unfortunate for the Al Gore camp, full of crap. It's political reviewed, not peer-reviewed. common sense would dictate we're entering one of the coldest winters in decades, and nowhere to come, you can't find Al Gore. So don't think that I'm all of a sudden in lockstep with liberalism because I am talking about chimpanzees and ending research on chimpanzees. One thing has nothing to do with another. And our truth is truth is truth. Humanity is humanity is humanity. Now, if you'd rather talk about cars, we can compare a Porsche to a Ferrari. I can talk about that as well. You like a 911S? Do you like the Ferrari 360 Modena? Actually, the Italian that I know in the Ferrari shop call it a Modena. I never liked the 360. I had one. It was too rough. It was a hard-riding car. Well, you want to get into a Porsche 917, one of the most iconic sports racing cars of all time? I mean, it's a racing car valued at $3 to $5 million. Only 65 of them were built. Most of us have never seen one of these things. One thing has nothing to do with another. You say, well, I'm not going to drive a Prius. The Prius is passe, number one, and the Prius, you don't see them outside the Bay Area very much. You know what? It's funny thing is I came back to the Bay Area. I did not see one Obama bumper sticker in Florida, and there's plenty of liberals there. They don't ride around like schmucks with Obama to show that they're a member of the party. You know what I mean? Here you come back right away to the Bay Area, Obama bumper sticker already. Obama bumper sticker and the self-righteous little Priuses that agitate me. So, I mean, you know, one thing has nothing to do with another. You want to talk Porsche versus Ferrari? We can do that. The new Ferrari California, if you'd like me to talk about it. I don't own one. I looked at one. I'm not going to buy it. I'll tell you why I'm not going to buy it. I mean, it's nice. It's like the houses in San Francisco with the Queen Anne front and the Mary Ann behind. And it's the same with the Ferrari California. It's got a rugged anterior and a frumpy posterior.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Savage Nation Monday edition. In the last hour, we were talking about Harry Reid calling Obama a light-skinned African-American with no Negro dialect in a new book that came out that he said about that. And that the same book says that Bill Clinton, it was revealed in the book, apparently has said during the campaign of 08 that a few years ago, Barack Obama would have been getting them coffee. And yet, of course, the radical left has aligned themselves with this. And, you know, to me, whether it's really a racist remark, what Reid said is, you know, open to, you know, you can argue over it. Light-skinned African-American with no Negro dialect. He was trying to explain why he's popular amongst white people. And he's not the first, you know, candidate to change accents according to audience. As I said to you, it's well known that other politicians change the cadence of their speech according to the audience. Obama himself... His consonants tended to linger a bit in front of black audiences, and he would speak with a certain staccato and rhythm in churches that he wouldn't use when addressing white audiences. Hillary Clinton used the Southern accent very often, and to the point where it became shocking. So we dug through our archives here on the Savage Nation, and we wound up with this satirical piece that was done before the last presidential campaign. It's quite funny. Listen.
This is Graham Hancock with a special report for Michael Savage. It seems that Hillary Clinton has had a break with reality. She's become completely psychotic when she's talking to different churches and different groups, she's taking on different accents. Let's listen.
I don't feel no ways tired. I come too far from where I started from.
Good Lord, we can only wonder what she would do if she went in front of a Jewish audience in Boca Raton.
So you think I talk with an accent? Well, you know, it's because I went to a deli the other day, and the people told me, you're going to order a bagel here. You're going to talk like the rest of us here.
Shocking. We can only imagine what she would do if she were visiting a mosque.
Praise be to Allah. We must convert the infidels to a new, more peaceful way of thinking and living, as you do, my brothers and sisters.
Well, there you have it. This is Graham Hancock signing off, praying for the renewed mental health of Hillary Rodham Clinton. Back to you, Michael Savage.
David, you're such a bad boy. I didn't know David Rubin had done this, but I thought I would introduce it for comic relief in the midst of all of this argument about whether Harry Reid is really a racist. You know, that whole argument bothers me. If it said it, didn't say it, if it was Republican, this and that, we got bigger things to worry about. We have a dedicated enemy on the march around the world, and most of us are blind to the inhumanity of these people and the nature of these people and what they would do to you if they get the chance. And the country's flooded with a lot of sleeper cells who've been activated over the last few weeks. That's what the ruckus is, you know, on airplanes. It's all distraction. They're planning something bigger. I mean, it's possible they're planning something bigger. And so that's why I said, because the Islamo-fascists are dehumanizing the world, including the killing, the bloodthirsty killing of their co-religionists for political gain, we must not let the Islamo-fascists dehumanize us. And I think the best way to begin is to remember that we have a responsibility to the animals that God has placed on this earth. And I'm focusing on chimpanzees because they're so close to us genetically. And I am saying that we should stop all animal experimentation on chimpanzees. And that's an important thing to talk about, and we've been talking about it on the Savage Nation. There's a news story I want to point out that I just got out of the Daily News. It's a very sad one. I think it happened this afternoon. Famed Coney Island strongman Joe Rolino, age 104, was killed today after being hit by a minivan. And you say, just another accident. But think about the irony of this. A man is 104 years old. A man has lived all this life, and to get killed by a minivan and mowed down on a Brooklyn street. Many people in Brooklyn are mourning the death of this short but strapping senior citizen whose face was always creased with a smile. People knew him, and people are sick over this, knocked off by somebody in a minivan. Rolino was unconscious and unresponsive when cops arrived at 13th Avenue in the Parkway shortly before 7 in the morning. He died. Police questioned the driver of the green 1999 Ford Windstorm and even not charged the motorist with a crime. They won't identify it. So Rolino was a lifelong vegetarian who ate oatmeal every morning and swam laps in the ocean year-round. Rolino would have turned 105 on March 19th. He was just 5'4" and 122 pounds at his prime. He became famous on a local boxing circuit in the 1920s for his ability to take a punch. He said, "Fighters would hit me in the jaw and I'd just look at them." He said, "You couldn't knock me out." Rolino was also a former Coney Island strongman who billed himself as the strongest man in the world and once lifted 450 pounds with his teeth. I'd like to know what he ate because... Now, here's an interesting part about this great man. He was born in South Brooklyn, and Rolino served in the Pacific during World War II. And he proudly wore the Silver Star, the Bronze Star, and three Purple Hearts that he was awarded after he was wounded in the legs by shrapnel. Now, this is an amazing American man. Dead today, 104, struck by a car in Brooklyn, New York. Just a little, you know, snapshot of what happens in life. Yeah, I know. Somebody up there likes me. All right, let's talk about any of these topics. And lab testing on chimpanzees. The alleged racist remarks of Harry Reid and how the liberal left is covering for him. Here, for example, is Dianne Unfeinstein saying we're all not perfect. Listen to clip 10.
I don't think so. First of all of us are imperfect. Clearly, this was a mistake. Clearly, the leader misspoke. He has also apologized.
Oh, he made a mistake and he misspoke, but I didn't make a mistake and I didn't misspeak and I should be banned from England. Dianne, you're supposed to represent me. You don't represent American people. You represent the Chinese government, and everybody knows that. I'm sick of these double-talking liars. Now, here's Minority Leader Tom Daschle. Remember that doll? Commenting on Harry Reid's racist comments. Listen to 11.
Just about everybody in politics who's been in politics for more than about 6 months can sympathize with Senator Reid. It's happened to me. It's happened to President Obama. It's happened to virtually anybody. And I think that is really one of the hazards of public life. And you just have to accept it.
Really? Well, how come he hasn't been banned from the United Kingdom? How come you won't lift a finger to help me? An American member of the media whose politics you disagree with, yes, who you have not lifted a finger to get off the list of banned individuals. I am on the same list as people who kill people. I'm on the same list as people who blow up airplanes. I'm on the same list as Russians who killed 10 immigrants and videotaped it. And you do nothing about it, all of you rotten, stinking politicians. The only one who did anything about it was Representative Culberson. All the rest of you stink to high heaven. You're a bunch of lying bastards, all of you, Republican and Democrat alike. I'm sick of all of you. You're a bunch of filthy liars. I'm going to take a break.
Savage.
So famed Coney Island strongman Joe Rolino, age 104, gets knocked off today by a minivan. He survives a Pacific War, fights like a hero in World War II, wins Silver Star, Bronze Star, three Purple Hearts. Unbelievable to get knocked off by a minivan at 104 in Brooklyn. They don't arrest the driver. They're not identifying the driver. I wonder why. I can only imagine why the driver's not. He doesn't look like... He looks like Timothy McVeigh, probably, that's why. Because he doesn't look like Timothy McVeigh, they won't identify the driver. The only thing I have in common with this Joe Rolino is that I eat oatmeal in the morning about once a week. I am not a vegetarian. I mean, I've tried it. Like last weekend, I needed meat. I was feeling very, to use a macrobiotic phrase, yin. If you understand yin and yang. When I get yin or I feel like a weakness entering my body, if I eat meat, I get stronger. And I know it's got to do with the carnitine, for example. Many of us are obsessed with fat. A human being never ate fat in their life. Go look at the traditional people and see what they eat. The fat, the obsession. Many of you raised children. No wonder they're anemic and sick. You feed them diets that you wouldn't feed to a chimpanzee, to a rabbit. The children are dying for a piece of meat or a piece of chicken or a piece of fish. They're not getting B12. They're not getting iron. They're not getting carnitine. And you wonder why the child can't focus in schools, and then go give him a pill because Dr. Quack told you he's ADD. Maybe he needs a decent meal. Yeah, I eat oatmeal in the morning once in a while on cold days. I can't say I like this stuff. I eat it. But I needed meat over the weekend. Friday night I went to a local Italian restaurant. I normally don't eat. I eat calamari and schmalamari. I'm sick of fish. I ordered the grill plate. Oh, my God. When you haven't eaten meat in a long time. Well, it started earlier with me opening a very expensive bottle of Italian wine after the show on Friday. I was in the mood for it. It was overrated. It's a funny thing with wine. I really prefer a beer, to be honest with you. I don't know what it is lately. But anyway, I went in the restaurant. They let me bring the wine in without corkage, which is nice. Because I know all the waiters. You know, I give them a bigger tip. And I ordered the grill. It had a lamb chop. It had a piece of steak on. But they had a sausage on that plate. And if you don't eat sausages a lot, and then you have one. Something funny happened. You got to listen to this. So Friday night, I sit down. I grumble. I don't want to go. Don't bother me. I'd rather stay home. I'd rather make spaghetti and green peas. Leave me alone. No, you'll be happy. Go to the restaurant. Go to the restaurant. So I order the grill plates. It's a funny side story. I cut into the sausage, and it squirted right into my eye. I swear to God. It was like God was saying, don't eat me. Don't eat. Right into the right eye. Luckily, I had my glasses on. And the hot fat went right into the eyeglass. It was so delicious, I almost fainted. I couldn't stop eating it. So I go to the restaurant the next morning. I couldn't get the sausage out of my mind. It was so tasty. I said to the waiter, he went over that morning. He asked the chef. So he told me the name of the brand, which I'm not going to mention because they don't advertise. But the style is a Calabrese sausage. That's the style. So I go to my local Italian deli. And they don't have the brand that I'm looking for. They have their own brand of Calabrese. It was awful. Dreadful. So it just shows you how brands are important in products. I never tasted anything as good. And then I went back to dinner at the same restaurant Saturday night with friends who insisted on taking me to dinner. God bless them. And I didn't order what the Mrs. S. ordered, the same exact dish. I reached over. I tried the sausage again. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. But end lab testing on chimpanzees, and is Harry Reid a racist? On the two questions for the day on the Savage Nation. It's going to rain here tonight on the West Coast. A storm is coming in. I came back from Florida for the warm weather. They got 30-degree weather in Florida. Can you believe this? As I said to you, because of global warming, I mean, we all know how true it is. I bought a house down in Florida because it's going to become the new San Francisco, Southern Florida. And I figured I may as well get ahead of the curve, you know, since we're going into climate change. I may as well have a house, you know, that was once in the warm zone now to go into this. It'll be, you know, in a year or two, maybe a month or two, unless the great Obama saves us with the cap and trade. I'm sure some Miami will become San Francisco in the next 3 minutes. All right, we're talking about all these different topics. I already have a migraine from. No, I think it's good. I think it's very, very good. Let's talk about all these topics on the Savage Nation. Larry, Santa Maria, California, go ahead, please.
Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to talk about your running for Senate or whatever from someplace in the world. I'd recommend California for some reason. They're going to spend $100 million to keep her in office. They might as well spend it here in California to stimulate our economy. And also,
I would be a better senator than either Feinstein or Boxer. That's given hands down because I have no special interest that I answer to. I would run on a very simple platform of borders, language, and culture. I would use the California National Guard, not in Iraq or Afghanistan. I'd put them on the border with Mexico to help our border patrol. That's number one. I would put a California highway patrolman in front of every emergency room in the state of California. And if you're not a citizen, you don't get any care. Unless it's a catastrophic accident, you're not going to get care for a common cold, which costs the taxpayers $3,000 or more. I can run very, very careful campaign. I cut government by at least 10 to 20% across the board. I would do an awful lot of things that the people want done that Feinstein and Boxer would never do in a million years. And on that alone, I could run with a very small amount of money. Whether I will actually do it is another question. I don't know. I'm tossing up a lot of things right now. 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. I have a reminder for you. If you are interested in the lab issue, the lab testing issue, we have a very interesting guest coming up at the bottom of the hour. Kathleen Conley is the Director of Program Management at the Humane Society of the United States. Why don't you just listen and learn? And see if you can relate to the idea of pain and distress in animals that are being treated like people in a Mengele laboratory. I am trying to reach out to conservatives on this show who are very confused about animals in that because of the brainwashing of the golfer, where anyone who talks about animals or animal rights is considered an environmental wacko or an animal rights wacko. That's easy to say. That's knee-jerk stupidity of the kind you would find from liberals. And I would expect nothing more from the disc jockey who got lucky. I really wouldn't. But if you had the blessing of having a diverse life as I've had, with many different careers, including a career in science, in animal research, then, you know, you learn different things. It's like not knowing something and talking about it, or knowing something about something and talking about it. Unfortunately for most of you, most of the conservatives in radio either were disc jockeys who've been at this game for so long that you start to think they know what they're talking about, or they were lawyers who are pretending that they know everything about everything because they're a lawyer. I'm very fortunate. I've done a lot of things in my life, and I can bring all of my experiences to this show. And by the way, most of these so-called conservatives in radio have no children. Incidentally, the big family values guys. Check into their backgrounds. Most of them have no wife and no children, but they're experts on family values and how to raise a child. Find out why they have no wife or children. So these are some of the things that you need to look into instead of just going at the knee-jerk, whatever they say is true and the animals are made to eat and ha-ha-ha. They're made for hunting and killing and eating.
Savage.
So, look, I've talked about politics today, and I've also campaigned to end lab testing on chimpanzees and orangutans. And people will say, gee, that's an odd thing for a conservative to do. No, it's not odd at all. I've long been an animal rights activist because I have worked in science laboratories going back to the late 60s. Remember, I have a PhD in nutrition and epidemiology. I have quite a background in this field, and I walked away from a fellowship because I wouldn't kill lab animals. It's just that as I get older, I start to empathize more with suffering on the planet. And I am telling you that chimps who have a similar range of emotions to humans deserve special care and treatment. And I'm not alone in this. I'm a late comer to this. Right now is a lady who spends a lot of time working solely on this. Her name is Kathleen Conley. She's Director of Program Management on Animal Research Issues for the Humane Society of the United States. Ms. Conley, thanks for being with us on The Savage Nation. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
Now, you've worked with these animals for a long period of time. Let's start with the science, per se, and not go into the emotions. Are there not computer models that can be substituted for chimpanzees in drug research today?
Absolutely. We have seen, when you look at the science of using chimpanzees in research, they have failed over and over again. So I think first we need to talk about the failures. So we became into this situation with having chimpanzees in laboratories because they bred so many of them thinking they were going to be the answer to HIV research, for example. And the time and money that was wasted is just unacceptable.
And what do you say failure? When you say failure, what did you mean failure? I don't quite follow that part of it.
I'm glad you asked that. When you inject chimpanzees with HIV, for example, they don't develop AIDS as humans do. But it was always thought, oh, they are so much like us. I mean, understandably, people would think, oh, they're so much like us, they must make a good model.
Oh, so what kind of disease do they come down with? What type of diseases? Because the HIV virus, as we all know, opens the human body up to opportunistic diseases, which are varied. So what does the animal get?
Well, the animal did not get ill from the virus, is what ended up happening. And the scientists.
It did not get ill from the virus. That's fascinating. I mean, that would tend to corroborate to a certain extent, but I'm getting sidetracked now, the origin of the disease itself, wouldn't it?
Right. And importantly, this is we've seen this over and over again, not just with HIV, but other diseases as well. So I just want to emphasize the failures that have occurred as a result of using chimpanzees and the time that we wasted trying to find cures for these things. And there are alternatives available.
What would the alternatives to using chimpanzees in medical research be?
For example, recently there was a hepatitis C breakthrough where they can culture the virus in a test tube, for example. And this holds a great promise for testing vaccines and other ways of developing treatments for people with hepatitis C. And also,
You have worked for years at a primate breeding facility as the manager of breeding and behavior, and you manage the colony of primates in 3,000 individuals in size. Is that correct?
That is correct. So for 7 years.
And what have you observed working with these animals? What have you observed about them? I mean, I understand that I'm an amateur with this. I have worked in labs with rats and walked out on a fellowship because I wouldn't kill even rats, but that was a long time ago. Isn't it true that chimps have a similar range of emotions to that of human beings?
They absolutely do. And working with chimpanzees, it's almost shocking. You catch yourself off guard, assuming that they don't have a certain ability, and every turn there's something they can do that you just are amazed at. And you know, once you look into their eyes, it's just you cannot turn your back on them. And that's why I'm driven to get them out of laboratories like I do every day now.
Now, what do you do every day? Tell me what your job is.
So we at the Humane Society of the United States are advocating to end the use of chimpanzees in research for exactly the reasons you're pointing out, their emotional capabilities, their cognitive abilities, and not only ending their use, but we have an obligation to provide them with a better life than where they are now. For example, providing them with sanctuary. And there are some amazing sanctuaries out there. And
well, I've given money to the Chimp Haven over the years, but I want to get more activists involved in this. I gave some money last year to a group that saved a herd of elephants, but when I look at the chimpanzee and I realize how they're tortured in a laboratory and I hear their screams when their mates are being strapped into a gurney and taken away, they must know what's going on, don't they?
They absolutely do. And actually, we did an investigation into this issue and have video footage of that very thing happening. It is heart-wrenching. People told me they couldn't even watch. And it just reminds me, I mean, I had an infant this year, and to think about those moms who have babies snatched away from them and taken.
You mean you as a human had a human infant, correct?
Yes, I had an infant this year, a baby.
No, because you started to empathize so strongly, I wasn't sure for a minute. And so what you're saying is that when a chimp mom, if you want to call her that, let's say a female chimp, when they take a baby chimp away from her, she goes crazy, correct?
Absolutely, absolutely. It is heart-wrenching. And having experienced that myself, I can't imagine what those poor chimpanzees go through.
So what are the arguments from the medical, from the pharmaceutical industry to the contrary? What do they say?
Well, the people who really are in opposition to what we're trying to do are the laboratories who are actually holding the chimpanzees. And they are making millions of dollars off the backs of these animals. And they have no interest in getting out of this because it's a business for them. They are
Wait. But you mean, I understand that many of these animals are not even being used. They're just being housed. How does that work?
Correct. So right now, like I said, they bred a lot of chimpanzees back in the 1980s thinking they'd be the answer to HIV research. And they ended up getting what they call a surplus of chimpanzees. So now the government is paying these laboratories millions of dollars every year to literally warehouse them. So about 90% of the chimpanzees in laboratories, and there are approximately 1,000. And each and every one, of course, is important. Each individual is important.
So you're saying that they're not experimenting on 90% of them. So what is wrong with them just taking care of them? That wouldn't they get the same care or better care than they would get in sort of a chimp haven type of situation?
No, absolutely not. And if you look at the video footage at our website, humanesociety.org, and I'm pointing out the website so people can see for themselves. It's so much easier to see than to just hear someone speaking of it. Animals living in barren conditions, concrete and steel, you know, no blankets, no...
What if I, Michael Savage, wanted to raise money to build the equivalent of a chimp haven somewhere in America, let's say Florida, California? How much would it cost to build such a facility to house, let's say, 100 animals? How much would it cost to build, and how much would it cost to maintain?
You know, I don't know the cost of building it. It would vary on what type of enclosures you would have. But, for example, right now it's $29 a day to pay for a chimpanzee at a sanctuary, where it's costing up to $50 in a laboratory.
Oh, that's interesting. So it's cheaper to maintain them in a sort of mock wild setting in a sanctuary of $29 a day, as opposed to $50 a day. It's like prisoners in a jail cell, which would cost more than it would be to release most of them.
Well,
who are in for nonviolent crimes, maybe using marijuana or something.
This is a very important point. I'm glad you brought this up. The millions of dollars that could be saved. You know, not only are they wasting money keeping them in labs, they could save money sending them to a better environment, like Chimp Haven that you talked about, where they live and can climb trees. And
well, look, I'm going to make you an offer that you can't refuse. Kathleen, where am I reaching you, by the way? Which city?
I'm in Maryland.
Okay. Oh, boy, the heart of animal experimentation. I know why you're down there, because of all the government laboratories. I'm going to make you an offer. If you could put together a budget for me and my show over your, you know, at your leisure, let's say a budget that would be required to build a facility excluding the land in, let's say, Florida or California, because both climates probably, well, Florida would be much better, wouldn't it?
Florida would be a great place. That's where a lot of facilities are.
Yeah, I don't think that they would like to live in Northern California. I don't even want to be here. It's so cold. But let's say we put them in a warm climate and we build some kind of facility that's kind of okay for 50 to 100 animals. I don't know how, proportionately, if that's too big. But let's say the amount that's manageable. How much would it cost to build? How much would it cost to maintain? And I'll try to raise that money for you. Would you be interested in that? Because I want to do something like that.
Well, I would absolutely be interested. You are an answer to my prayers.
Well, you see that? God has given me something to do with the next year of my life.
Somebody needs to pinch me. That would be phenomenal.
No, well, I've done things in my life that are good, and I've done things in my life that are not so good. And the older I get, the more good I want to do than not so good, you know. And there's nothing I've done that I really regret, truthfully, but I'm just saying that on the scale of a human pain, why make more pain on the earth rather than less?
I couldn't agree with you more.
All right. So look, we're speaking with Kathleen Conley, What is your website, Kathleen?
HumaneSociety.org.
Okay, and I'm going to ask Kathleen to come back on the show when she has her budget, and I'm going to do everything I can to fulfill my promise or commitment, whichever way you want to do it, assuming I can meet that requirement. I don't know what we're talking about here in the scale of dollars. I haven't any idea.
It would be in the millions.
Well, doesn't mean that I can't raise it. It's better that than trying to elect a politician.
Absolutely have faith that you could.
I'd rather raise millions for chimpanzees than for Barbara Boxer, Dianne Feinstein, or any of the politicians who are running out there. At least we get something for it. But I tell you, I know I have such a cynical view over the world that here I am, I'll raise the money, I create the haven for the chimps, and as I go there, I visit one day, one of them attacks me and rips my face off.
No, they would not do that. You have to, those poor chimps.
No, I know that story from Connecticut. That poor animal, I don't blame the animal, I blame the woman who, frankly, I thought was abusing the animal the way she was living with it, as though it was a human. Wouldn't you agree with me on that one?
Yeah, that was a tragedy on so many levels.
I heard she was bathing with the chimpanzee, having wine with the chimpanzee. They put Xanax into his water or something.
Yeah, he had not a good life, and we have programs where we're trying to end the use of chimpanzees as pets as well.
Yes, I understand, and I appreciate all you do for humanity's sake, because the important part of this discussion is, on the one hand, yes, lessening the suffering of these wonderful creatures which are so close to us genetically, but on the other hand, it's to humanize human beings even more, because we're living in a dehumanized world. And my feeling is that if we can provoke people to feel something for an animal which they can no longer feel for themselves or for fellow humans, maybe it could become a more humane world.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think it's important that no matter what your political views, helping these animals and ending chimp research is...
Bingo, that's right. It's not a conservative, liberal, Democrat, Republican issue. It really isn't. It transcends both. Bless you. You're doing God's work, in my opinion, Kathleen. Good luck with your baby, and I do look forward to that budget.
Well, thank you so much. I'll get that to you right away.
Okay, I'm not kidding you either. It's 46 minutes after the hour. You're listening to the Unexpurgated Savage Nation. I'll be right back.
Savage.
This turn, this, like he's going to pass, for example, for white America because he's, got this Negro dialect that he can turn on or turn off, and he's light-skinned. That's anachronistic language. It harkens back to the 1950s and 60s, and it confirms for me a mindset that is out of step with where America is today. But I can assure you that if I had, as national chairman, said that, well, it's all behind us and he's apologized, let's move on, no one would be accepting that. There has to be a consequence here if the standard is the one that was set in 2002 with Trent Lott.
Well, that's Michael Steele, head of the RNC, talking about Harry Reid's Negro comments. It was in context of the double standard, and he was referring to the fact that a Republican had said it. Listen to clip 8. That's important to hear.
Oh, yeah, there's a big double standard here. And the thing about it that's interesting is that when Democrats get caught saying racist things, an apology is enough. If that had been Mitch McConnell saying that about an African-American candidate for president of the United States, trust me, this chairman and the DNC would be screaming for its head, very much as they were with Trent Lott. And the reality of it is racism and racist conversations have no place today in America.
All right. Well, it's an interesting question. Is it really racist what Harry Reid said? I'm not trying to defend them, but, they're just attacked because it looks like an opening wouldn't make me, a more honest man. It would make me, just jumping in on a pile-on thing here. The fact of the matter is, I don't know what to make of it. I think you have to be a black person yourself to understand how you feel about it. But the fact of the matter is, this comment where he says that Obama is light-skinned and that he carries the advantage of having no Negro dialect unless he wanted to have one, is really not that different from remarks that Obama himself made during the rise to the White House. Because the fact of the matter is, it was only 2 years ago that Obama was struggling to persuade some African Americans that he was black enough. And his electoral prospects did not actually rise very quickly among Democrats in the South Carolina primary where black voters are critical until he won the Iowa caucuses, where the vast share of voters were white. And so the reason he became president is primarily because whites were not, let us say whites were attracted to him. And the reason they were attracted to him was really not about race. It was about the fact that Bush was such an abominable failure, and so were the Republican Party. Let's not defend the indefensible here. Of course, I warned you what he was before he was elected. I warned you that he was not a mainstream Democrat. I warned you he was a far leftist. I tried to warn you of all of that, but you didn't listen to me. And even Democrats are coming to regret it. I call it voter remorse. And if you look at the actual candidate himself, when he spoke to black audiences in some cases, Obama's consonants tended to linger a bit. He spoke with a different staccato and rhythm in churches that he didn't use when addressing white audiences in Iowa and New Hampshire. But this is not unique to Obama. Other politicians are chameleons as well. In fact, the same is true of Bill and Hillary Clinton. When they need Southern accents, they use them, for example. And in fact, I have to play it again. Listen to the entire Hillary Clinton piece from years ago.
Always tired. I come too far from where I started from. Nobody told me that the road would be easy. I don't believe he brought me this far to leave me.
I rest my case. So, politicians, you know, you have to read Machiavelli, The Politician, to understand that they're all the same. You know, you change your tune according to the audience, and you say one thing to one group and one thing to another thing to another group, and then you win the job, and the next thing you do is you screw everybody, and you're out for yourself. By and large, that's true. Is that the human condition? Probably. It very closely approximates most of us in many ways. That's the sad truth. No one is perfect. No one is a saint. It's just that the level of deceit in the national, on the national level, has never been higher. And I in my lifetime, and the level of incompetence, naked incompetence. You don't have to look any further than the strike two, the two strikes in the national security arena under the Obama appointees. There's another story I just linked up on MichaelSavage.com, for example, about the education secretary was never taught in a classroom. You hear this one? Obama has picked a man to be education secretary who was never taught in a classroom. How in the world can you be an education secretary never having taught? How is that possible? Another political hack. What is he doing, you know? What is he doing picking a guy like this who has never taught in a classroom to be a secretary of education? I guess it's the same as the Secretary of Defense, who may never have been in the military, I suppose. That's what we're getting used to now. Let's see, pick another one, Department of the Interior. Or take Janet Napolitano, the head of the Homeland Security, was never in security. She was a mediocre, you know, actually a rotten governor, who left the gates to Mexico wide open, did not support the U.S. Border Patrol, so she was rewarded for all of that by being made Department of Homeland Security, and she says there is no terrorism as near as 6 months ago. The only things we have to face are earthquakes and tornadoes and global warming. So how different is that than the Democrats under Obama picking somebody who were never taught in a classroom to be a Secretary of Education, as picking somebody who knows nothing about national security to head up the DHS? Or go down the list. Go down the list. That's all. Here's another one, Al-Qaeda veterans flooding into Yemen. Yihadis from around the Arab world are hiding in the lawless hills of Shaba province where the so-called underwear bombers thought to have been trained. Hey, there's a solution to that. You know, like when all the ants go for the sugar pile, what you do is you spray the sugar pile with DDT or you poison the sugar. Hello, that's what bunker buster bombs are for. Take down the entire mountain range. Use the damn ships, for God's sake. Launch them already.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Well, this is what's on michaelsavage.com, and I'm only going to read you the stories that I think you're going to miss elsewhere. Headline, Radlib Oliver Stone sympathizes with Hitler and Stalin. That's right. I've warned you about liberals. I've told you they're fascists. Certainly not all liberals are fascists, but the most extreme liberals have fascistic tendencies. Here is a man named Oliver Stone who comes up with a miniseries for television on Hitler and Stalin and others, where he says he wants to correct the misinterpretations of history. And he says that Hitler is misunderstood, he's a product of his times, and Stalin he can relate to. Can you believe this? Now, it's no surprise that the radical anti-American director, Stone, is once more expressing sympathy for the devil. After all, he gave the Cuban murderer Castro a glowing portrayal in a 2003 documentary. The same Oliver Stone attacked American soldiers fighting in Vietnam. He has celebrated violence, leftism, and the decline of America in one movie after another. But maybe you leftists, or you Democrats, or you liberals, didn't think Oliver Stone would go so far as to come down on a sympathetic view of Hitler and Stalin. Maybe you thought that was something that even the demented mind of a liberal wasn't capable of. But you were wrong. As I wrote, liberalism is a mental disorder, and I believe Oliver Stone belongs in an institution, not in Hollywood, unless you consider Hollywood an institution. Hassan, remember Major Hassan? Major my behind, who killed so many people at Fort Hood? A defense review found the doctors overseeing Hassan's medical training repeatedly voiced concerns, yet they continued to give him positive performance evaluations that kept pushing him up through the ranks. That's right. Even the military has been so caponized by political correctness and affirmative action that they couldn't bring themselves to criticize someone who had clearly demonstrated terrorist tendencies. They knew Major Hassan was a ticking time bomb. They knew he espoused radical Muslim views. But they also knew how it would look if they gave bad reviews to one of the few Muslim psychiatrists in the Army. And so they didn't give him a poor performance review or even throw him out of the military. So instead he was pushed up the chain, and over a dozen lives were sacrificed on the altar of political cowardice. Survey from the London Telegraph, also on michaelsavage.com. Unbelievable. Brits grow leery of Muslim diversity invasion. London Telegraph. A large proportion believes that the multicultural experiment has failed, with 52% considering Britain deeply divided, and 45% saying religious diversity has had negative impact. The British have had lesson after lesson on the perils of diversity. The British shoe bomber, the London bombings, the hatred that comes out of the Finsbury Park Mosque, the foiled airline plot of 06, the release of the Lockerbie bomber. The list goes on. Now it seems that the majority of the Brits are finally starting to understand the threat from within. Let's hope that it's not too late, and the descendants of the proud Anglo-Saxons who created Britain will take the reins once again.
They let you into the country as well.
Yeah, good luck. Museum yanks Muhammad art accused of having jihad jitters. New York Post. Is the Met afraid of Muhammad? The Metropolitan Museum of Art quietly pulled images of the Prophet Muhammad from its Islamic collection and may not include them. You see, offending Christians is fine for artists. In fact, it's required if you want to get ahead in the communist art community, the CAC. That's why museums are allowed to show crucifixes in jars of urine, or let us say a crucifix wrapped in elephant dung. But try to depict even a respectful image of Muhammad, aha, and now you're under the threat of terrorism. I guess to the left, some religions are more equal than others. Here's another one on michaelsavage.com that you're not going to want to miss. What is good for the Nazi works for a jihadi, says Marvin Heyer and Abraham Cooper. They say that President Obama was right when he declared in the Detroit debacle that, quote, we have to do better. $42 billion later, Americans do not feel much safer getting on an airplane. Why? They say, apparently Obama is more concerned with 90-year-old Nazis getting into the country than he is in stopping the fascists of today. There are only 1,700 people on a list of those banned from entering the U.S. Do you think that that includes all the vermin around the world that our intelligence services know to be plotting the deaths of U.S. women and children? Not a chance. Some other headlines on michaelsavage.com. Catholic Church, big engine to legalize illegal immigrants. Huh. America's Osama bin Laden was captured but released in 2002. The Democrats are launching a counterattack to save Harry Reid's career. Well, they got a lot of work to do. Let's focus on one of them, which is from CNS News. Catholic Church big engine to legalize illegal immigrants. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops will push to get immigration reform legislation enacted in 2010. The Catholics have voiced support for one Democrat-sponsored bill that grants a pathway to citizenship. You see, the leaders of the Catholic Church don't seem to care what happens to America so long as the pews are filled. It may mean even more jobs lost to American citizens. It may mean jails filled to the gills with criminal illegals. It may mean drug gangs roaming the streets of America. It may mean real Americans unable to get health care in hospitals. But as long as the collection plate has a few extra pesos in it, the Catholic leadership is okay with it, it seems to me. That's what's on michaelsavage.com. What do you think about that? These are some of the headlines from michaelsavage.com.
Savage.
The Spanish philosopher Jorge Santayana said those who cannot learn from history are doomed to repeat it. In a recent article entitled Liberal Muslim Axis, Ellis Washington looks at the connections between the liberal mentality and radical Islam. Ellis Washington, welcome back to the Savage Nation. Give us the background of your article.
Thanks again for having me on your wonderful show, The Savage Nation. What prompted me to write the Liberal Muslim Axis with a lot of my articles, Michael, came from you. The way you talk about liberalism and your trenchant analysis and putting liberalism in its proper historical context in American history really went a long way. And then your unapologetic critique of the Muslim and radical Islam, I began to see these seemingly two disparate ideologies have a lot more in common than most people would have thought. And so I started doing my own analysis of liberalism and particularly its comparison with radical Islam, and I found a lot of startling similarities.
Well, like what?
I first started off the article by talking about the historical context of World War II. Your listeners will remember, during World War II, we had two sides, essentially. We had the Allied powers, which consisted of England, France, Russia, and America. And then we had the Axis powers, which consisted of Germany, Italy, and Japan. And those two opposing forces fought basically all over the world. I mean, that's why they called it World War II. And from those battles came, fortunately, it for the side of good, won out after the Six-Year War from 1939 to 1945. And I said, just like we had those two forces where good and evil were clearly demarcated, fast forward to today, we have this liberal-Muslim axis where the liberals and the Muslims, because of their visceral hatred of the Judeo-Christian traditions in America, have become, bedfellows or unwitting bedfellows of one another, because a lot of their ends means paradigm are going to fall in the same place. For example, the crotch bomber that happened a couple of weeks ago, where this guy from Nigeria tried to put a explosive in his underwear and tried to detonate it on a plane bound from Amsterdam to Detroit. Well, what do liberals reflexively do whenever we have an attack by a Muslim on an attempted attack, a terrorist attack? They punish society in order so they won't seem like they're appearing to attack the Muslim faith, rather than profiling young Muslim men who are the primary perpetrators of terrorist attacks across the world. They put us, meaning law-abiding citizens, all at an inconvenience.
It's truly ironic that the libs defend radical Islam so strongly.
Yes, that's a great point, Michael. I call them mirror opposites of one another, which what I mean is when you look like at a mirror image of yourself, in one respect, it looks exactly like you, but in the opposite respect, it's just the opposite. Like when you raise your right hand from the mirror's perspective, it's your left hand. And consequently, when you raise your left hand from the mirror's perspective, it's raising its right hand. And it's like that with this liberal Muslim accent. They're like two sides of the same coin. Okay, they're separate. When you look at them, they look different, they act different. But like, for example, liberalism is outwardly a political entity. But inwardly and surreptitiously, they behave more like a very radical religious cult. And on the flip side of that, Islam is outwardly religious, but inwardly and surreptitiously, they're a radical political ideology.
What do you think brings these two sides together?
What I think brings this liberal-Muslim axis together is its visceral hatred of America, exceptionalism, and its Judeo-Christian traditions of intellectual thought. That's why when you look at just about, look at the health care. Let's just take that. The health care bill. It's obviously, to anybody that knows anything about the Constitution, you don't have to be a constitutional law scholar, but just anybody. The federal government can't demand that we the people, the American people, buy anything, let alone health care, which is going to be 1/6 of our economy, a multi-trillion dollar tax increase that's going to be heaped upon us. And liberals are, you know, just, it's fine. They're fighting tooth and nail to get this thing through. Obama doesn't care what's in the bill. He just wants to get a toehold on this because he knows the devil's in the details. And once they get it passed, they can shape this bill in any way possible. And, of course, it's just going to be a terrible outrage against our constitutional rights. Bring in Islam. Islam hates the Judeo-Christian traditions, okay? It says in its own scriptures, I believe it's Surah 9:5, it says, fight and kill the infidels, unbelievers, wherever you find them. Michael, that's a commandment. That's not a suggestion. So this is a religion that does not believe in compromise. Just like the liberals in Congress right now, they have both houses of Congress, they have the presidency. They're not in a compromising mood because on a very substantive, basic level, they believe they're fascists, and they believe in just dominating and taking no prisoners, not in constitutional principles and separation of powers and things like that, which are, you know, anybody that knows about the Constitution, those are foundational principles. Liberals don't care anything about that. They're fascists. They're going to cram this health care, and then next is amnesty for illegals, and on and on and on. They're going to just cram it down America's throat, and they're going to fix it so, Michael, that subsequent Congresses won't be able to undo this tyranny and this treachery against the American people.
In World War II, we had the Allied forces. What do you think it's going to take now, Ellis?
Michael, that's the $64,000 question. Excellent question, sir. We, back then, 70 years ago, good and evil was clearly demarcated, but now we've had this thing called relativism, and they've had this separation of church and state where they've kicked out Judeo-Christian traditions out of the courts, out of politics, out of culture, out of society. And especially since the 70s, society has just really gone down the tube where strong men that we've relied on in the past, people like George Patton, people like MacArthur, people like Joe McCarthy and these heroes, Ronald Reagan and those kind of people that stood in the gap to preserve American exceptionalism and American principles, those guys are few and far in between. Now we have these people, you know, like Sarah Palin. They're very amorphous. They talk, you know, a good game, but once you scratch beneath the surface, these guys are just, they're just pretty much like the Democrats. They just like the popularity. They like the adulation of the crowds, and they're not really interested in pushing the conservative movement into the 21st century. So basically, Michael, to ask your question, I can't really answer it. It's just a big question mark. There's an empty seat on the American stage, so to speak, and what man or woman will fill that to lead the conservative movement, God only knows. But I pray that this person will be revealed and that he'll be a strong political figure like Ronald Reagan, like Joseph McCarthy, like George Patton, to bring us back on the right road of American exceptionalism.
Ellis, thanks for being on the Savage Nation once again.
Michael, once again, I want to just thank you for giving me this opportunity. One thing I'd just like to say to you and the Savage Nation audience is this piece must have really struck a deep nerve with the liberals across the world, because the blogosphere, if you just put in my name, google.com, my name, Ellis Washington, and the Liberal Muslim Axis, you will see all kinds of really crazy viewpoints coming largely from the liberal blogosphere. And I think because of you, Michael, and your uncompromising views on promoting American exceptionalism that I tried to codify in this article, it's really began to affect, you know, the liberals, where they can't really argue with any kind of credibility against these trenchant ideas on based on truth, based on liberty and freedom. And I just want to thank you for being such an inspiration to me and helping me in my writings and getting the cause of American exceptionalism, not only here in America, but to the four corners of the earth. And please continue to fight, Michael. We love you, and we love your stand for truth.
I'll be right back.
Savage.
The midstream media reports almost nothing of the actual turmoil that's going on in Iran, where the people are revolting against Ahmadinejad, the Hitler of our time. Joining us now to give you an update is Ken Timmerman.
Michael, I think one of the big stories that the national media has been missing about Iran has been the extent of the internal divisions within the regime itself in Tehran. You have growing divisions between Ayatollah Khamenei and Ahmadinejad, the president. You have a division that's growing inside the Revolutionary Guards. You have divisions within the traditional clerics. And you have, of course, a lot of divisions within the opposition and people who are protesting on the streets to get rid of the regime and others who are protesting to just kind of reform it. In my latest story, I talk about two particular divisions, those in the Revolutionary Guards and those splitting Ahmadinejad from Ayatollah Khamenei. An extraordinary thing happened during the summer. There was a number of people who were picked up and thrown in jail, included sons and daughters of senior leaders of the regime. One of them in particular, a 26-year-old boy named Mohsen Ruhollahmani, turned out to be the son of a Revolutionary Guards general. He was raped in prison, in Kazarak prison, along with two other people, raped and then murdered. I am told by my sources in Iran at a very senior level within the regime that there was a closed-door meeting between the father of Ruhollahmani, who's a Rev Guards general and an advisor to the former commander of the Revolutionary Guards, Mohsen Rezai, and Ayatollah Khamenei. There were approximately 100 senior officers from the Revolutionary Guards Corps at this meeting with Khamenei. And Ruhollahmani protested. He said, look, my son has been killed. This is wrong. And injustice has been done. What are you going to do about it? And Khamenei, the supreme leader, essentially blew him away, blew him off. And he said, you know, be quiet. We don't need to talk about it. It's already happened. It's passed. Let's move forward. And Ruhollahmani, instead of shutting up, as Khamenei expected he would do, he then quoted an ayah from the Quran, first in Arabic and then in Persian. And the particular verse from the Quran goes like this. If you shed the blood of an innocent, your blood in turn should be shed. Now, it's a very well-known saying within the Quran, and the whole principle is that it is illegitimate to shed the blood of innocent people. But here you had this general, Ruhollahmani, saying to the supreme leader of Iran, you have shed the blood of an innocent. And that is an extraordinary accusation. And Khamenei was stunned when he heard him make it. And after that, in fact, ordered an investigation into the killings, into the murders at Kazirak prison. And in fact, he ordered the closure of Kazirak prison.
Well, why is that important?
It's important because inside this ruling elite of the Revolutionary Guards, which in much of the reporting that you hear in the national media is solidly behind the regime and behind Ahmadinejad, inside this ruling elite, you have people who are breaking off, breaking away, who are disgusted with the crackdown against the dissidents, who are disgusted with the violence that's being used against the Iranian people when they're rising up in these nonviolent protests. And I think that's a very, very significant fact. Now, Michael, the second part of this, if you wish, is the growing rivalry, to an extent, between Ayatollah Khamenei and Ahmadinejad. Again, the version that we hear in the national media is that they are joined at the hips, that they need each other, and all of this is true. Ahmadinejad is a creature of the supreme leader of Khamenei, but I have a story which is creating quite some consternation in Tehran. I've learned from my sources that Ahmadinejad was a bit upset when President Obama sent two letters to Khamenei seeking better relations between the United States and Israel. And after the protests broke out in Iran this summer over his stolen election, his so-called re-election, Ahmadinejad sent his top advisor, a guy named Mashai, to meet with Israeli diplomats in a European city to explore whether Israel might be willing to help him, Ahmadinejad, to open up a back channel to President Obama.
No, you're making this up.
I mean, this is an absolutely extraordinary story. Here you have the man who is openly called for the destruction of the state of Israel, who calls for Israel to be wiped off the map, who yet so believes in occult Israeli power that he sends his top emissary to go meet with an Israeli diplomat, hoping that the Israelis will then help him to meet Obama at the UN General Assembly in September. I mean, it's got all the ingredients of Middle East conspiracy theory and these back-channel dealings, which are so fascinating in the region. I had this confirmed me at a very, very high level, and I've heard since the story came out that Khamenei is furious that Ahmadinejad went behind his back. He offered the Israelis basically to say, look, if you can set me up with Obama, make me the man of the U.S. connection. So that would increase Ahmadinejad's stature inside Iran. He was hoping to then be able to distance himself from Khamenei and the crackdown against protesters inside Iran. It's a complicated domestic political game. Ahmadinejad has been caught. Khamenei is now trying to figure out what he's going to do. This information is beginning to circulate in Iran in various opposition websites right now. But it has been discussed at a high-level meeting between Khamenei and his top security advisors over the weekend. So they are actively looking at, you know, what are they going to do about Ahmadinejad and this rogue outreach to the state of Israel seeking to enhance Ahmadinejad's stature inside Iran.
Some are saying the protest movement in Iran is not building momentum.
They don't believe that it has staying power. They think that the regime will succeed in cracking down hard enough that the opposition simply melts away. There was an article written by Flint Leverett, a former CIA analyst who worked in the Bush White House in the first 2 years of the George W. Bush administration, broke with the administration, became a vocal critic of George W. Bush, the war in Iraq, and especially the Bush administration's policy on Iran. Flint Leverett and his wife, Hillary Mann Leverett, wrote an op-ed in the New York Times last week where they say, no, there's not really any serious opposition. This is all being exaggerated. The regime is here to stay. They will crack down. They've got things under control. Nothing serious is happening. Well, that's exactly, by the way, what Ahmadinejad and his supporters want us to believe. They want us to believe that they're in control, and they want us, the United States, to do business with them and not with the protesters in the streets. I've got to tell you something about Flint Leverett. This is a man who has never been right about anything and who has never hesitated to broadcast outright lies. After he left the White House in 2003, he began spreading a story that the Bush administration had missed a tremendous opportunity to have a serious dialogue with the regime in Tehran in May of 2003. He claimed that the regime had sent a detailed working plan of how they could, you know, negotiate a grand bargain with the United States, that they were willing to negotiate a grand bargain with the United States. Well, it turned out this was not a regime offer at all. It was the invention of the Swiss ambassador in Tehran. But Flint Leverett to this day continues to claim that it was a missed opportunity by the Bush administration. Even Colin Powell, who was in fact looking for opportunities to dialogue with Tehran, had the Iran analysts at the State Department look at this particular letter that was brought in by the Swiss ambassador, and they determined it was not a serious initiative. It did not come from the Iranian regime. And then basically it was a fantasy dreamed up by the ambassador and by Flint Leverett.
What else has he said?
Well, Leverett has also said that, along with people like Trita Parsi, who's a Swedish-Iranian living in the United States and has never ceased to put forward the regime's point of view here in Washington, they have also put forward this notion that the Iranians were helping the United States in Afghanistan after 9/11. Well, you know, I've written a lot of stories about this in my book, Countdown to Crisis, The Coming Nuclear Showdown with Iran. The truth is exactly the opposite. U.S. intelligence was picking up convoys of Iranian four-wheel drive vehicles exfiltrating al-Qaeda and al-Qaeda family members from Afghanistan into Iran in October and November of 2001. You know, in other words, right after the 9/11 attacks. They also saw that the Iranians were using aircraft, both helicopter and fixed-wing aircraft, to bring al-Qaeda people out from Afghanistan into the safety of Iran. Some of those people included family members of Osama bin Laden, and we've just heard over the past week that some of those family members, the younger ones, have now sought refuge in the Saudi embassy in Tehran, claiming that they had been under house arrest all these years. Well, I can tell you from my sources, Saad bin Laden, the oldest son, has been cooperated quite well with the Iranian regime up until quite recently. So all in all, Michael, it's been a lot of news coming out of Iran these days, and as always, a lot of disinformation from the national media here in the United States.
Ken Kimmerman, thanks for keeping us updated.
Savage.
Well, the racism of this liberal regime has shown itself once again, this time in the comments about black people of Harry Reid. And yet the entire left-wing power structure is defending Harry Reid. Here's what Dianne Unfeinstein had to say when asked if she thought Reid should resign.
I don't think so. First of all of us are imperfect. Clearly, this was a mistake. Clearly, the leader misspoke. He has also apologized. He's not only apologized to the president, I think he's apologized to all of the black leadership that he could reach. So the president has accepted the apology, and it would seem to me that the matter should be closed.
Here's what the tax cheat Tom Daschle had to say in Reid's defense.
Just about everybody in politics who's been in politics for more than about 6 months can sympathize with Senator Reid. It's happened to me. It's happened to President Obama. It's happened to virtually anybody. And I think that is really one of the hazards of public life. And you just have to accept it. When you look at his value to the caucus, to the country, to the president, when you look at the fact that these things happen occasionally, you look at the fact that he's handled it very deftly, he's apologized, I don't know that there's anything else he can do, and the fact is that he's a leader this country needs right now.
So wait, racism is what's needed in a Democrat leader? Wait, it goes on. Listen.
Oh, I think everybody recognizes that that isn't the way he probably should have expressed it. He probably should have said it differently. In fact, we all agree that he should have probably said it in a way that it would have been less hurtful. But it's something that he could have said more diplomatically, more effectively. And I know he regrets having said it the way he did. The president knows what an important ally Senator Reid is, but he also knows that the president himself has experienced circumstances where he could have worded things differently, as I have. We've all been there. We all understand. We're all sympathetic to these circumstances because they happen to all of us.
And then Reid steps out to talk about it himself.
I've apologized to the president. I've apologized to everyone that, with, in the sound of my voice, that I could have used a better choice of words. And I'll continue to do my work for the African American community. I'm very aware of the fact that the first African American to serve on the federal court in the state of Nevada was a direct work I did, recommending Johnny Rawlinson to President Clinton.
And of course, he appreciates all the leftist lackeys who have lied for him.
I really appreciate people writing nice things about me. There's a wonderful editorial in the LA Times today and a number of things on the Huffington Post, nice things there. But I am very proud of the fact. I can still remember the meeting that took place in my office with Senator Barack Obama, telling him that I think he can be elected president. And I'm sure there were others, but he was kind of surprised that the Democratic leader was calling this new senator over to suggest that he could be elected president.
But naturally he wants to move on.
So I'm not going to dwell on this anymore. It's in the book. I've made all the statements that I'm going to. Thank you all very much.
But don't forget, this isn't the first time Reid's used racism for his own ends.
All Republicans can come up with is this. Slow down. Stop everything. Let's start over. You think you've heard these same excuses before? You're right. When this country belatedly recognized the wrongs of slavery, there were those who dug in their heels and said, slow down. It's too early. Let's wait. Things aren't bad enough.
Cock-a-doodle-doo. Here are some headlines from newspapers around the country from the NY Times. Goldman Sachs weighs requirement for charity. The Hill says Dem lawmakers visiting Detroit Auto Show prompt Tea Party protests. San Francisco Chronicle, speeding fines being linked to income in Europe. A $290,000 speeding ticket was slapped on a millionaire Ferrari driver in Switzerland. Now you may say, well, oh, so what? The rich can afford it. So you think there should be differences in fines depending on your income? That's called communism, schmuck.
I guess they changed it from each according to his speed.
Los Angeles Times, Northern Ireland in uproar over lawmaker's secret affair with teen. That's a female, age 60, had an affair with a 19-year-old male and then steered money towards him. Huh. And you thought it was soda bread, huh? The Hill, Obama and labor leaders to square off over tax on Cadillac health plans. Politico, Republicans charge a Lott Reid double standard. Wash Times, interagency gaps allowed bomb suspect to retain visa. Bush advisor says system okay, but lack of focus is to blame. They'd know a lot about that. Politico, Obama budget likely to include fee on banks to help taxpayers recoup cost of bailout. Sure. Wash Times, GOP seeks converts on health care. Republicans target 37 Democrats on Medicare funding, abortion, and federal budget. Those are the headlines from the country right here on the Savage Nation. Good radio is good radio. The variety of the personality depends upon the personality. You could do politics till you're blue in the face and people would not listen to you. You could do it till you're blue in the face and they will listen to you, depending upon who you are and your delivery. But if I would only do politics, I would have left this business a long time ago. As I say to you, I am a communicator, and I've been brought up to admit what's going on inside me to people, you know, when I want to now. And certainly not everything. I mean, if I told you everything that was going on inside me or everything I did, I'd be crazy. That would be the mark of insanity. It's a public show. But I admit doubt. I admit pain. I admit grief. I admit failure. I don't think failure is dirty like a disease. I've had failure in my life. But I remember being taught when I was a young boy, how many times have I told you the story about my father's friend who was the bar owner, the tough guy that all the boys loved the most? The other guys were very nice, the men. Every man in the constellation of father's male friends were decent men, good men. Nobody ever did anything. No one touched anyone inappropriately. I don't even think it entered their mind. I don't know how this happened. But anyway, everyone was a decent guy. But this guy was a standout because he was unlike the rest of them. He was a tough guy, a street fighter, wound up owning a bar, a gambler, very unusual. Quiet, soft-spoken, hands like the size of... But quiet to women, to his wife, the nicest man on earth. But the boys gravitated to him. And I remember what he told us about, you know, what to expect in life. He said, you know, you can only wear one suit at a time. You don't have to be rich. He used to tell us things like that. You don't have to struggle to be rich. And then he would tell us things like, do you know how many times my rich friend has been down and had nothing? He said three or four times he's had nothing and come back. He said he used to say things to us like he knew how to bounce back. Now, as a kid, you don't know what the word bounce back means. But when you get older and you've been kicked in the teeth a few times and you're in the gutter of your soul, you have to learn how to rise again like a phoenix. And that's a very tricky thing to do. Most people get knocked down once and they never come back from it. Do you know that? Play some music for a minute. It's Blue Monday on the Savage Nation.
I found my thrill on Blueberry Hill. On Blueberry Hill. When I found you.
This is the Savage Nation.
Savage.